Hello, Austin. Thanks for not going to the Frank Abagnale talk. Yeah, you couldn't get in. I couldn't either. Hey, I am awesome, very happy to be here. Now, a couple years ago, I did something on a dare, which was a little crazy. And I thought, well, every year people keep asking, you're going to do it again, you're going to do it again. But I'm decided this year, instead, we're going to do something a little different. So here's what I need you to do. Right now, I need everybody to stand up. And this will only take a moment, but this will work best. You got to pay attention because I'm going to teach you a couple of killer dance moves. First thing you're going to do is this. Then a little of that. And then we'll do a little this, and then we'll do a little that. You ready? Yeah. Okay, I want to see you do it. Let's go. Come on. Enough, sit down. No one's ever done that before. But that's not what I came to talk to you about. No. I came to talk to you about science. In particular, I've gotten very interested in the work of a particular woman scientist, one who actually people are very, very familiar with. I'm sure you know her work. She's been doing this since she was very young. Of course, I'm talking about the work of Lisa Simpson. Now, Lisa did an experiment when she was very young, which involved taking a tooth that had fallen out. And instead of putting it under the pillow for capitalist reasons, she decided to turn her donation to science. She put it in a bowl, she put it under her bed. And in the act of doing that, she then went to bed. Next morning, she took the bowl out. She looked at it through a microscope. And she discovered that overnight, an entire civilization had evolved. One which, curiously, worshipped her as their creator. And in watching this episode, it occurred to me that there are lots of things that have little secret lives that we don't realize. And one that I spend a lot of time looking at in my work is links. So for the next hour, we're going to study the secret lives of links. And to start that, I want to start on April 8th, 2011. You probably remember this day. This was a very important day in American history because it was the day that Congress tried to shut down the budget one of the times. And on this day, the CNN website was reporting the story of Congress shutting down the budget. And in the process of doing this, they had to put up all these different links. And I was really interested in this. And I got even more interested as the day went on because more and more links appeared. They kept restructuring the page. They kept putting up new links, new stuff. And as it finally reached a deal, they had even more links and more stories. And I thought, wow, here is this team working all the way through the night. It was a Friday night. And their job was to constantly redo all the links on the homepage. That was a lot of work. And I thought, you know, there's got to be an easier way to do this. So I did something I never do. I decided to design something. I'm not a designer. I'm a researcher. You don't want anything I design. I'm going to show that to you in a minute. I've never designed anything in my life. I've never designed a website in my life. In fact, it's a life goal of mine to never design a website. I figure I'm about halfway there. But I decided to take a stab at designing a brand new CNN website, one in which they would not have to spend all night changing up the stories as it progressed. And here's how I decided to do it. We'd start with a page that has the CNN logo. Of course, anticipating what they're going to ask, I'll make it bigger. But then, this is the really brilliant part, I think. We're going to have a link on the page, and the link just says, the most important story. We'll have another link right after it says the second most important story. Another link that says the third most important story. We'll have a link that says an unimportant yet entertaining story, because this is CNN. Because this is CNN, we will also have to have another Snooki story. And because it's CNN, we'll have to have crap you don't need. That will be the page. That will be the whole thing. Of course, you and I both know why I'm not a designer. It's clear. This can't work. Right? No one would want this. Because it isn't just having links on a page that makes a website. It's having links that talk about what you get when you click. The thing is that the CNN site, it already has all those things. It has the most important story. It has the second most important story. It has the third most important story. It has an unimportant yet entertaining story. And crap we don't need. It has all that stuff. So we don't have to add links for that. And this is the deal. When you study links, you realize they secretly desire to get you to the content. And it's the design of those links that get us there. Now let's look at the CNN site in 2007. The physical design of this page is completely different than what it looks like today. Yet, all those same elements are here. And they've been on the CNN page from day one. And that's because in order to produce a news site, you have to have those things. Here, this is what CNN looked like on April 8th. This is what the New York Times homepage looked like on April 8th. Notice that the links are a different color, that they are a different font, that they are in a different place, that they are with a different grid. Yet, they tell the same story. Because the story doesn't change. Here's what the LA Times looked like on that same day. Completely different design, same story, so the links do the same job. Huffington Post on that day. Apparently, going through its own budget crisis, they could only afford two words. But it worked. So all of these links on this page did its job by communicating what it needed to do to get you to the story. It turns out there's a whole body of science that has to do with how links pull this off. It was originally created by the same people who invented Windows displays and mice, the folks at Xerox PARC. They named it the science, the scent of information. And the scent of information is all about how links pull the user through to the content. The way that the folks at PARC put it out there is very simple. The way people navigate large information spaces, like a website, if you model it mathematically, actually looks identical to the same way that a bee searches for honey or that a fox chases a rabbit. So it turns out that we are ingrained informivores. We are born with this. And the links are there to provide scent to the content that we are searching for. So we use the scent of information to get us what we want. Here's an example. This is the MIT website. Now, on the MIT website, the page layout changes practically every day. As a student, you can actually submit your own design for the homepage of MIT. And if they like it, they will actually put it up for a few days. And then you can like send a note home and say, hey, my design is on the homepage of MIT. And they can say, that's what we paid for. They can do this because they use standards. They use HTML5 and CSS3 and all these great standards that allow them to have the same links, the same sent to the content, independent of the actual design of the structure of the page. So they have sort of taken advantage of this sent, and they put it up there. Now, interestingly, if you look real close at these links, they don't tell you very much about MIT. They sort of expect you know that. It's very different than, say, Oberlin College's homepage. At Oberlin College, they don't assume you know what Oberlin is about, so a lot of the links on this page are dedicated to explaining to you why Oberlin is a really cool college, which it is. MIT does not have a lot of links explaining why MIT is a really cool college, because if you don't know that, you should not be on their homepage. So the design of the links has to do with the mission of the organization. That's really clear over at the Yale School of Art, whose mission is to prove that ugly can be artful. Or let's look at, say, Ohio State University. Is there anybody here from Ohio State? Yeah? OH. It's amazing. You can make them do that anywhere. Does the name Pavlov ring a bell? Okay? It's just awesome. Buckeyes. Go Buckeyes. Here's the deal with this, right? This is a beautifully designed website from someone who goes to the school's purpose because they have useful things like being able to find people on campus or getting the academic calendar or looking up your grades. And the links are right there on the page. While a lot of universities offer these facilities, it's really hard for students to get to these things. But the design of the Buckeye site here, the Ohio State site, actually does a fabulous job of this. And we can think about this, right? We can look at a site like Walgreens. And Walgreens is, in particular, a sort of average e-commerce site. There's nothing special about it. But we can start to dissect what's happening on the Walgreens site. So if we looked at the analytics of the site, one of the things we would learn is that the most popular link on the homepage is actually this link here. It's the photo link, where one out of every five visitors actually clicks on photos. Turns out that getting photos from the Walgreens site is their most popular function. The next most popular thing to do off the homepage is to go to search. So 16% of the users go to search. After that, 11% go to refill their prescriptions. So this is one out of every nine people are clicking on this to refill their prescriptions, and you can add to that the other one out of 20 people or so, 18 people, who are going to the pharmacy link. And the fifth most clicked on link on this page is the store locator. One out of every 20 folks tries to find a physical store from the website. So these turn out to be the five most clicked on links. And they account for 59% of the traffic on the site. But interestingly enough, they only account for 3.8% of the area of the page. 96.2% of the page is dedicated to stuff that less than half the users want off the homepage. And this, for those of you who have been trained in any sort of user experience or human factors, will recognize this as a prime violation of the key directive of human factors, which is known as Fitz's Law. Fitz's Law basically states that the speed that a user can acquire a target is directly proportional to the size of that target and directly interproportional to the distance from that target. In English, it means if the sucker is big and close, it's easier to hit. And so when designing something, if we really want users to hit it, we make it big and close, which is really telling about this page. Because the things that are big and close are not what the user wants to hit. They're what the marketing people at Walgreens want the users to hit. And this is an instance where marketing people win. There was a meeting and the marketing people won. And we all know what happens. When marketing people win, puppies die. Over at the New York Times, they send out emails with their headlines. And the email with the headline says that one day Lady Gaga managed to bring down Amazon servers by offering a 99-cent version of her first album, or her latest album. And so you want to find out more about this incredible feat of hers, you would click on the link there in the email, and you would hope it would bring you to a story about Amazon's demise under Lady Gaga's rule, but instead, it brings you to a page that has an ad for something, whoever, hell knows what it is, and what you need to do is find the very, very small link in the upper right-hand corner. It says, skip this ad. The three most hopeful words on the internet. Puppies died. This is a bicycle manufacturer in Italy, and these dudes make fabulous bikes, top-end frames. And the thing about these bikes is that the folks really have something to show you in terms of their products, in terms of their story, in terms of what they do there. And so they contracted out. They don't make websites. They make bikes. So they found some design firm to make them a beautiful site. And you can see the site. It's got nice big places to hit that talk about their products and their stories and what they're about. Except this isn't what users see. When users bring it up in their browser, they only see the top small portion. So what happens? They have to add that navigation up at the very top there because they have to counteract the fact that the design isn't working because you couldn't see the thing in the real page. They took a print design and tried to port it to the web. And this is what happens, right? Links want to deliver their users to the content that those users desire. So in order to make this work, we have to give them a design that lets them do that. Links also want to emit the right scent. Let's go back to Ohio State here. So, someone on campus may want to figure out where the library is. It's a big campus. It's actually a lot of libraries, so we'll find out which one. They want to find out when the semester ends because it feels like it's going on just a little too long. They may want to figure out what their math grade is going to look like. So here we have links to do all those things. And those links have very specific terms. And the way those terms were chosen, you know, map versus academic calendar, it's called a trigger word. Trigger words are a word or phrase that get the user to act. They trigger the user to act. Trigger words are the most important thing. And here's the deal, right? We've all been designing links on pages, yet do we understand how to design them well? Have we had conversations about this? Right? Imagine you're a chemist and you didn't have the periodic table. How would you talk about chemistry? We have to have a language that talks about the things we're working on. Trigger words is part of that language. It's how we describe the things that cause users to click. And trigger words turn out to be really important. And we know this because of research we did. I've been studying people using websites now since 1995. We did something incredible back in 95. We got a handful of folks, and we sat them down in front of a handful of sites. And we did something no one had ever done before. We watched them. We just sat and watched what they did. Now, at the time, we had a theory. And the theory was that if you had a lot of experience using the web, remember, this was 1995. The web had only been around for a couple years. If you had a lot of experience using the web, you would be able to find things on these sites better than people who'd never used the web before. That was our theory. And we were really confident about this theory because it had been the way that usability had worked ever since the dawn of technology. If you were good at something, you could do it better. It seems like a tautology, right? So the more you did it, the better you got, the better you were at it. So that's what we expected. So we got a bunch of people. Some of them were really experienced. Some of them had no experience whatsoever. You can still find those people then. And we put them down in front of websites, and we said, go ahead, find stuff. And we gave them things to look for. And guess what? It didn't work. It turned out that there were some sites that were really good at getting people to what they wanted, whether you were used to using them or not, and some sites that were really bad at getting people to what they wanted, whether you were used to using them or not. And it had to do with the design of the sites. It's the first time we realized design mattered, that it wasn't the experience of the user, that the design trumped the experience. Since then, we have watched thousands and thousands of users, and we've collected up click streams of all these users using these sites. And even today, we see at best a 42% success rate when we ask people to find things on an average site. 58% of the time, they still fail. Some sites do way better than others, but this is the average across thousands of studies. And it's really shocking. And when we look at what caused these problems, we find that there are basically three things that prevent scent. And these things, we can predict that scent is going to fail when we see them in the user's clickstream. The first one is using the back button. The second one is pogo sticking. And the third one is using search, of all things. Let me explain. So we have all these click streams, thousands of click streams, and we start to go through them, and we're looking for patterns. Now, the click streams fall into two piles. One pile is when they succeed at finding what they want, and the other pile is when they fail at finding what they want. And so we start to see, well, what's different about these two piles? And what we notice is that the back button is playing a role in this. So we pull all the click streams that have a single back button out of the piles. And as soon as we do that, what we see is that that drops from that average of 42% down to about 18%. Then we pull all the click streams that have two back buttons in them. And their success drops to under 2%. What's happening here is that the user is failing to follow the scent. So they're hitting back. Because that's the natural thing. If you watch a fox chase a rabbit, it never sees the rabbit until the very end. Right? It's working off the scent of the rabbit. It chases that rabbit. Suddenly it finds the rabbit. Cool. But if it doesn't find the rabbit, it loses the scent. And when it loses the scent, every fox does the same thing. They go back to where the scent used to be strong. Now, it turns out for foxes, this works really well because rabbits are incredibly stupid. You see, rabbits, The reason the scent was strong was probably because it was either someplace they were eating or someplace they were living. Which means it was someplace they were pissing. And that's what made it strong. And so the rabbit probably wants to go back to that food or go back to their home. So eventually it'll come back, and the fox will figure that out. When a user works their way down a set of clicks and they lose the scent, they hit the back button. But the back button doesn't work for them because that page isn't stupid. It doesn't suddenly have scent that it didn't have before. The trigger words don't show up. They were either good or they weren't. And if they were the wrong thing, they led the person on the wrong trail. And as a result, it doesn't get better for that user. And the user can't take advantage of it. The back button in my office has become known as the button of doom. So if you learn nothing else today, I want you to learn this. So please, ladies and gentlemen, please repeat after me. The back button is the button of doom. See, we're in the South. We can do so much better than this. Let's try it again. Much, much better. I give this talk all over the United States, and I have found that you can tell by the region how good they're going to do. Because, like, when I go to Atlanta, they are in perfect synchronization. Because these people go to church. A few weeks ago, I did this in D.C., and it was just complete chaos because they can't work together. The back button is the button of doom. Because once you see a user use the back button, you've lost them. Now, this doesn't mean you want to prevent them from using the back button. Don't do what somebody did and then said it was my fault by taking their JavaScript and coding out the back button from their browser window. Bad move. This is a predictor. You want to see if they're hitting it and say, okay, they're losing scent. How do we get that scent back on the page? So that's key. Now, the cousin of the back button is something we call pogo sticking. Pogo sticking is this thing that we hear designers tell us they do intentionally, right? So we sit in a meeting and the guy will say, look, here's how it's going to work. If the user can't find what they're looking for, they'll go to what we call the gallery page, right? So the gallery page is this long list of links. And it says, we're going to go to that page and they're going to pick a link off of that list. And when they click on that list, that'll bring them to the target page. It's sort of like a Goldilocks thing, right? And they'll say, oh, this page is too hot. So they'll hit the back button. And then they'll pick the next one off the list. And they'll go to that page. They'll be, well, that's too cold. And then they'll hit the back button. And then they'll go to the next page. And they'll say, oh, that one's just right. Just like in Goldilocks. It doesn't work. This is a myth that this is how users use things. Turns out, in our thousands of click streams, when we pulled out all the pogo sticking, in the links that did, in the click streams that didn't have any pogo sticking, we saw success 55% of the time. But in the ones that had pogo sticking, it was 11% of the time. You don't want users to pogo stick. In fact, this is an interesting fact. On the sites that we studied that are e-commerce sites, 66% of all purchases happened without any pogo sticking at all. That means the user was not jumping from product page to product page to product page. They were choosing from the product gallery page the product they wanted. They would visit that product's page and buy it. They would not pogo stick. Didn't happen at all. And on those same e-commerce sites, when they did pogo stick in that one-third of users, when they did pogo stick, the more they pogo stick, the less they purchased. So this idea that users need to compare products by looking at each product page doesn't happen. They're doing it at the gallery page. And on non-e-commerce sites, the more users pogo stick, the less likely they find the information they're seeking. You don't want users to pogo stick. Now, the third the thing has to do with the fact, the third predictor has to do with the fact that there's only three ways that you can get from the page you land at, the home page or whatever landing page it is. If that page doesn't have what you need, right, you then have to go to some other page. We call that the target content page. So to get from that home page to that target content page, there's only three ways you can do it. You can use the site's search capabilities. You can use whatever category hierarchy the site provides you. Or you can click on the featured content that the site would like you to know about, that those big ugly boxes in the middle of the page. Those are the three ways you can get there. Well, when we watch users use search, it turns out that after watching thousands of users search for things on hundreds and hundreds of websites, every site the user behaves exactly the same way, except for one site. It's really weird, but they all behave the same way on every other site. The way they behave is they go to a site. So let's say we were at this site here, City of New Haven, and we needed to get a license for a dog permit. Right? So what the user does is they come to the page and they scan the page for trigger words. So their eye goes across the navigation at the top, then it goes across anything that looks like a link at the bottom. And if it doesn't find the trigger word, what do? They go up to the search box and type in a keyword. This is the way users behave on every page of every website except for one site. And that site is Amazon. On the Amazon page, when a user comes to this page, they don't scan it for keywords. Their eyes go straight to the search box. And that's because, after many years of business, Amazon has trained every user of the web that they never put anything useful on their home page. Fortunately for us, users don't assume that about every other page on the site, on the web. So for every other page, they scan and go to the search box. And when they go to the search box, what are they typing in? Trigger words. Exactly right. Okay? That's what they're typing in. It's as if they're trying to create their own link. In fact, we shouldn't call it a search box. We should call it BYOL. Because they're bringing their own link. Now, here's the deal. There's a tip here. Okay? If you manage your search, there's something really cool about this. Because if you look in your search logs, you will find a list of trigger words. Your users are constantly giving you trigger words on your site. So if you're wondering, how the hell do we figure out the trigger words of the user? They're in your search logs. Turn on the search logs. Watch the users come in. Even better, if the search logs are coded to tell you what page the user searched from, because, by the way, they only search from your home page approximately 7% of the time, I'm betting. Chances are they're deep in the site when they've lost scent, when they finally search from your page, right? So they're telling you what page they lost scent on. Put the trigger word there, possibly on the page before it. And that'll work. So when we looked at our click streams and we looked at search, if the users didn't use search, they succeeded about 53% of the time. When they used search, they only succeeded 30% of the time. You are 50% more likely to succeed finding something on a website if you don't use that site's search capabilities than if you did. So you don't want your users to use sites. So if they do any of these three things, they're telling you something. Now, to show you how we know this works, to tell you about something we did. And this, to understand what we did, you have to understand this thought experiment we had. And the thought experiment is called the 7-Eleven milk experiment. And the way the 7-Eleven milk experiment works is that imagine I have a magical device that goes off whenever someone in a 5-mile radius of where we are right now has run out of milk. And I hop in my pedicab and I go over to their apartment and I find them sitting in front of a dry bowl of cereal and an empty carton of milk. And I take them and I put them in the cab and we go to the nearest 7-Eleven. And then just to make sure they purchase, I give them the cash. What do you think the odds are in that situation that they are going to actually buy milk from that 7-Eleven? It's going to be pretty good. They'd have to really, you know, the 7-Eleven would have to really screw up to not sell milk to that customer at that moment. Well, that's exactly how we form our studies online. They're called compelled shopping analyses. And we go off and we watch people buy things. So in one study, we studied 13 different sites that sold women's apparel. So what we did was we found people who needed to buy women's apparel at that moment. Most of them were even women. We brought them to the site that had the products they wanted to buy. And then we gave them the cash to buy the products. Now, the way this works is that if we gave them $1,000 to shop for these products on the site, on the ideal site, we should have seen them spend $1,000 because it was a product they wanted on a site that we knew had that product. And they had the cash to do it. But in our studies, what we found was that of the 13 sites we studied, we didn't even get that. The best site was The Gap. And for every $1,000 we gave folks, they spent $660. Second best site was Land's End, which came in at $465. Of the 13 sites, the two worst performing sites, the second to last one was Macy's, which came in at $156. And the worst performing site was Newport News, which came in at $63 for every $1,000 we gave them to shop. So we became really interested in why there was a 10 times difference between The Gap and Newport News. So we took the 2,000 variables that we collected from each participant in our study, and we fed them into these huge statistical analysis machines. And it churned for a bit, and then out popped the variables that predicted what we saw. And it turns out that there was one variable, which we call number of pages to purchase, which highly correlated with the spend that we saw of these customers. And on The Gap, what this represented was the number of pages between the time they visited the homepage and the time they put their first product in the cart. On The Gap, it was an average of 12 clicks, 12 pages they visited. On Land's End, 16. But on our two worst performing sites, Macy's and Newport News, it was 51. So what was happening in those clicks between the Land's End there and Macy's? Three things. We saw a lot of back buttons, a lot of search, and a lot of pogo sticking. And here's what this sort of looks like when you translate it, right? This is from the Sony Ericsson site. I got four phones here. Which one do you want? Well, we could look at the T60LX, which is technology you can trust. Or we could check out the T60D, which is technology you can trust. Apparently, the other two phones are not technology you can trust. How do you know which phone? You have to pogo stick. The design of this page forces pogo sticking, as does this page. I've got three cameras, a Sony, a JVC, a Canon, all very good brands. The Sony comes in at over 1,000. The JVC comes in under 500. How do I know if I'm giving up good features? How do I know if I'm spending too much? I have to click through. I have to pogo stick. Now compare that to Crutchfield, who puts all the information right there on the page, on the gallery page, right? Crutchfield is one of the best performing electronic sites in our studies, and their pages rock. It turns out that they put all this stuff there. Now that's a lot of stuff to have on a page. It looks sort of cluttered, except if you're buying a camera. It's not cluttered, right? It's what you want. Clutter is an interesting word. Clutter, when we hear users use clutter, it almost always means there's way too much stuff I don't care about on this page. Users never use clutter when it means it's typographically dense. You can actually make a page more typographically dense and less cluttered at the same time from a user's perspective by adding things the users care about. So it turns out that clutter is what that means. So when you hear your users tell you that their pages are cluttered, they're telling you you don't got anything there they want. Check out this page from Bank of America. There are 6 different credit cards here. How do you choose? Well, you could choose the one that has 0% interest rate. Oh, wait. That's all of them. Or the one that has no annual fee. Oh, wait, that's all of them. If you look real close at the bullets on this page, they are exactly the same for each of the 6 products. So how do you pick which credit card you want? I guess by the picture. Here's Stoneham Bank's page where you got 4 different types of checking. We have select checking, e-select checking, choice checking, and, of course, Premier checking. You know which one you want, don't you? I mean, it's obvious. It's clear. Everyone should know. Or check out this one from Eastern Bank, right? Where we have paragraphs that actually describe what the products are, though not particularly well, but look at the links. They all say learn more, learn more, learn more. At what point on a product page do you want to click on something and not learn more? Learn more is the 2nd most useless pair of words in web design. The 1st most useless pair of words is click here. And then there's the granddaddy of them all, click here to learn more. Now, I have a ton of bad examples here because, well, good design is hard to point out. It's really quite invisible. It's like the air conditioning in the room, right? You don't notice the air conditioning in the room unless it's too hot or too cold or it's making too much noise or dripping on you. But you notice when it's not working. You don't notice when it's working well. That's the problem. Same with design, right? We don't notice when it's working well. So finding really good examples is actually really hard because when the scent is working well, it just works for that person because it has the trigger words that mean something to them. Showing it to you out of context is really hard, but I'll try. Here's a great design that works really well on, of all things, the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. They have these trigger words here that are exactly what experienced users want. But for people who are coming, who are not economists or people who know a lot about economics, they actually have these lovely paragraphs of definition that go into great detail. Another example is here, where on the NIHcancer.gov site, this is the treatments for a pancreatectomy. Now, there are 3 treatments for a pancreatectomy. There's a distal pancreatectomy, a whole pancreatectomy, and a Whipple procedure. Now, if you're a medical professional, you will recognize those things, and you'll just go ahead and click on the links. But if you're not a medical professional, let's say you're someone whose family member was just diagnosed with stage 3 pancreatic cancer, well, they then go off and explain it. And the beauty of this design is it works for both audiences. The people who know what those things are will see the trigger words and click on them. The people who don't know what those things are will read the paragraphs and click on the definitions and then move to the one that they're most interested in. It's a great design. It works well. So it is possible to do this. It just takes a lot of work. Now, links also live to look really good, but they have to still look like links. There was a day when we believed this to be true, when this was the most popular wisdom. Links should be blue and underlined. Thankfully, we have moved past this. It's good because blue and underlined, worst 2 things we could have picked. Blue is the hardest color for humans to perceive. At the age of 40, men's ability to discern shades of blue starts to go away. For women, it doesn't happen until they're much older because women are better constructed. Hey, us guys are pleased of that, too. We need someone to take care of us. But the other thing is that underlining was an awful choice. Of all the different attributes you can apply to text, underlining is the one that changes the shape of the words. And our brain basically uses the shape of the words. Unless you suffer from dyslexia, your brain looks at whole words or phrases, and it's the shape of the words that they actually use to code. So changing the shape of the words is a bad thing. So it turns out that we couldn't have chosen two worse things, and no self-respecting human factors person would ever have chosen blue and underline, which is why we left the job to the astrophysicist. But today, we don't have this problem. Instead, we have green links and white links and black links, and we have no trouble discerning them. Where it gets to be a problem is when it's not clear that it's a link. Here on this LA Times page, we don't know what's a link. Is that head a link? Is that subhead a link? Is that blue thing there a link? Is that paragraph there a link? Is that bullet a link? Is that dude a link? Is that caption a link? What the hell is a link? And the only way the user can find out is to grab their mouse and start waving it over the screen until the browser gives them the finger. Now, you can do this, right? Over at this is one version of the BBC News page. They change their design every other day or so. But this one here, it's got a very clear visual language. We can see what's a link. It's once we establish that the red bulleted things are links, it's easy to spot them. Even on something as clumsy looking as the Drudge Report, we can tell what the hell a link is. It's easy on this page. Or we can look at Matt Drudge's dad's website. Yes, Matt Drudge's dad has a website. This is it. And you can see his heritage. And all the links. He got that right. But look at this website, designed to attract people who are older and work in an area that is all about accessibility. Can you tell what the links are here? Well, this thing that says home is probably a link, and these blue underlined things are probably links, and the things labeled quick links are probably links. But is this a link? Is that a link? Are these links? Is that a link? Is that a link? Can't tell. There's no way of knowing. Over here at United, this is the old United website before the Time Machine sucked it back to 2002 with the new one. United. I believe if you look up clusterfuck in the dictionary, you will see the United logo. Just saying. Here, they use the visual language of blue text is a link, and it works. Except when the black text is also a link, or the blue text isn't a link, or this blue text isn't a link. Right. Here's a site from Intel, a survey from Intel. And so the blue stuff on the side looks like links until you go to click on it, and that's not a link. Wait, whoa, what? Oh, my God, what? Like, dude, if you want to click on this, don't answer our survey. Okay, so links, they don't have to be blue and underlined, but they do need to feel and look like a link. You have to establish a visual language for this. The last thing I want to talk to you about is that links really want to do what the user expects of them. Let's play a little game here. We're going to play a game I call Find the Content on This Page. It's here. That's all the content of this page. Okay, so this is some wacky startup page. It's obviously got no business model, so they went the advertising route. But let's look at one of the most traffic sites on the web, dictionary.com. Find the content on this page. It's here, amongst the clutter. It's very hard to find it. This is the problem with all these links, is that they actually make it hard to find what we want. We don't want the user to leave this page, we want them to stay, but yet we give them all sorts of links to leave the page. That's not cool. Not cool at all. And we see this trope happening time and time again, and it comes in these very weird things, and I'm trying to warn the web to stop doing this. Look, this is from Time Magazine's website. I'm sitting here, I'm reading an article from start to finish, and it's an interesting article. And suddenly I get to the end of a paragraph, and it has a link. Now, the article is about why the acceptance rates of various colleges. And this link says, it's really hard to read, but it says, see if parents are too involved in their college admission process. I'm reading this article because my kid is going off to college, and I'm thinking, am I too involved? Do I want to click on this? Or do I want to finish the article? Right? So then I decide I'm going to finish the article and maybe come back. And I read a little further, and then there's another link at the bottom of the page, and it says, see pictures of the evolution of the college dorm. Why the hell would I want to do that? Right? And this is so weird the way they do this. This is a Daniel Pink article. Daniel Pink is one of the best writers on the web, and he's got this article on the London Telegraph, and he gets four paragraphs in, and suddenly the website says, hey, want to go look at other links? Want to go look at other links? Right? It's like, we don't trust that this copy will interest you more than four paragraphs, so we're going to get your attention by sending you somewhere else. It's this huge statement that says, we don't trust you to read anymore. And it's partially done by people who work at news organizations, and I think it's because they don't actually read the stuff they put out. And so they put these links in to keep themselves interested in their work. My favorite is from the Chicago Tribune. This is an article. I'll tell you what this article is about. So you got to know the history of this. Some law firm in Alabama decides to put a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal saying that they're suing Taco Bell because Taco Bell claims that their beef chalupas are beef, and they claim that there's not enough beef in the chalupa to be beef, so they're not allowed to claim that. Taco Bell subsequently buys a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal to print the ingredients of their beef chalupa, number one ingredient, beef. Turns out it's like 70% beef. So they're like, dudes, we have the beef. Okay? And they demand an apology. So this article here is about this little advertising war that's going on between this law firm and Taco Bell. So you read four paragraphs of it. It's pretty interesting. And suddenly it's like, hey, check out our Sudoku and Jumbo puzzles. But even better, on the left, because it's an article about an advertising war about lawsuits, you obviously would want to click on ads that have to do with suing people and advertising. And the related topics have to do with a place called Bell, California, which neither the law firm nor Taco Bell has anything to do with, and newspapers and the judicial system. All this computer-generated crap is actually ruining the reading experience. This is why things like readability and Instapaper are seeing all this rise. But my favorite is the link in the middle of the article, the one right here that says Alabama. Because here I am, two paragraphs in, and it's like, shit, I want to know everything the Chicago Tribune has ever written about Alabama. In Columbus, Ohio, giving this talk, and we visited a place called Jenny's Ice Cream, and I love the ice cream, but I went to look them up on the website to show it to somebody, and the website has this crazy thing where you have to move the mouse over, and what you do, all of a sudden stuff starts to fly out, right? Like, oh my gosh, you can see this stuff. And this is the problem. This is very common, this meme, this fly out thing, right? And it doesn't really work for users. If you actually watch users, they have trouble with this because they decide what they're going to do before they move their mouse. They decide what they're going to click on. So this is what they see when they've decided what they're going to click on. And when we move the mouse, all of a sudden we give them other stuff. They don't know that's coming. So they're like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. And then they go check out other stuff, and it throws them and it confuses them. And it turns out that you see this all the time. And the thing is that there's plenty of space. We can make the big pink thing smaller, put all this useful content there, and then they could actually see all those things to decide on it. We keep feeling like we have to remove links from the page, but we don't have to remove links from the page. Users love links. That's why they came to the damn page. Right? And we don't like links. We need big pink things. Right? So it turns out I finally give the talk in Columbus, and at the end of the talk, these three people run up, and they're like, dude, you won't believe it, but we're working on the redesign of Jenny's site. Awesome. Let me know what it looks like. So we will. This is so helpful. Thank you. So then 3 weeks later, I get a link. Oh, dear. They were there. Were they not listening? This happens over and over again. And it's not just little places, little design shops. It's big companies doing this, right? This is Office Max playing find the link in the shell game, right? We're going to hide it over here, or maybe we're going to hide it over here. And people have trouble. The MIT Architecture School. This is the whole page. What the hell are they hiding? I love this, right? Watch. When I move my mouse down, it changes the shape, right? And of course, you know, I can get different shapes, but my favorite is over here, the first one. Go to the left, the first one. No, one more. Over the way. Yeah, right. Look, it's administration. It's a bigger hairball with every link. The other problem that you have is what's called the hysteresis problem, which is users want to move their mouse in a straight line. And what happens is they get there and it's like, okay, I'm going to move my mouse over here. Okay, that kind of worked. Well, no, wait, come back. Well, no. Well, because as soon as they leave the target area, the window disappears. So it's like, oh, damn. No. Ah. Don't. Run. Ah. Right? So flyouts aren't evil, but they don't help your users. And you got to use them very conservatively. And we use them way too much because they're really fun to code. They're really fun to run. But it's not what the user is expecting. The user is expecting the scent to be on the page. They want the links out there working for them. That's what they come to the site for. That's what they want it to be. Okay. We're going to go to Q&A in a moment. I have a couple minutes for questions. But before that, I have a couple sites to show you that, frankly, I don't have a reason to show them other than you got to see these. This is from the Delta website. My friend D.L. Byron sent this to me. If you look very closely at the bottom of the page, there's a link during this booking process that says, more info our lawyers made us put here. Now, I showed this to an audience a little while ago, and this dude comes running up to me. He says, that's my link. That's my link. I said, really? Wow. He says, yeah, I was working for an agency, and we designed that page, and we didn't know what they wanted, so we just put that in as filler, and they kept it. I'd like to think they did that on purpose. Over at Chase Online Banking has my favorite link ever. See fewer choices. I mean, who doesn't want fewer choices? Tell me. It's great. It's a fabulous feature. They should put that in their brochures. Of course, when you click on it, you get a link that says, see more choices. And I do want to take you back to the Yale College of Art. There are a couple things to note here. The first one is this link that says everything else. Awesome. But the next is, if you want to go to the College of Art, the number one thing you learn is how to do animated GIFs. Turns out they specialize in animated GIFs, and not just your sort of puny little animated GIFs, like this one here. They work on GIFs that take up entire pages. Right? These are epilepsy-inducing GIFs. This is what you learn at the Yale School of Art. Anyways, that's what I came to talk to you about. Links really want to deliver their users to their desired objective. They want to emit the right scent. They want to look good while still looking like a link. And finally, they want to do what the user expects. It's our job to let the links live the lives they want to live. And so that's your job. Now, before you go, I have a special offer for you. Because this is South By and this is what we do the special offer thing. So this is my Oprah moment. So here's what we're doing. Nothing to do with links. Turns out in the next couple months, we are producing a book, a PDF ebook. It's on web-based applications. If you work in the realm of web-based applications, you can have this book for free. All you have to do is send an email to webappbook@uie.com, and you get a book, 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 and you get a book. Hey, dude, so I got time for questions, or am I out? Out? Okay, I'll be here to answer questions. Thank you very much for encouraging my behavior.